Free City Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is Wednesday, the 13th of October. Today on the broadcast, we are going to be featuring an interview with author, political scientist Timothy Mitchell, who wrote the book Carbon Democracy. This is an exploration of the ways that fossil fuel industries have shaped Western political consciousness over the last 100-plus years. This movement does point to anti-colonial resistance, to the imposition of colonial pipelines dating all the way back to the early 20th century. This book, I think, is very important to highlight the ways that fossil fuels today continue to shape political possibilities. We talk also about the ways that Canada's economy is shaped by a dependence on fossil fuel extraction from Indigenous territories, including lands of the Wet'suwet'en people, who have been opposing a colonial pipeline on their territories for many years now in the West Coast. Those are the subjects that are addressed today in this conversation with author Timothy Mitchell. I really do recommend his book, Carbon Democracy. This is Free City Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. There is a new episode every Wednesday at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. Do stay tuned. Here's our conversation. I'm joined by Timothy Mitchell, who's a professor based in New York City and wrote the book Carbon Democracy. I think in many ways, it is a work that explores the sort of frameworks of conception of economics, labor, the political field within which we exist, and how that's tied to fossil fuels, British imperialism, of course, starting with coal, but then extending to sort of Western hegemony, and how that is fundamentally linked to our sort of universalist frameworks, but actually how, in fact, fossil fuels shaped all that. Now, that's a very attempted summary at some of the really important ideas in your book, which I'm sure you can outline much more clearly. But I guess just to start, thank you so much for taking the time to speak today.
Oh, thank you, Stefan. It's great to be here.
Right on. Thanks. So first of all, I do hope people take the time to read this book. But if you were to say, like, quickly, what was, like, when you sort of set out to deliver or to share the ideas in Carbon Democracy, what were, like, some of the fundamental points that you felt were really essential to communicate? And I'm sure that you felt like a sense of urgency to sort of, the book obviously took a long time, but to sort of communicate these critiques and on some of the key fundamental points, what are you trying to share with this work?
Yeah, well, the book did take a while, and it actually began in the aftermath of the US invasion occupation of Iraq, at a time when there was a widespread understanding that being an oil producing state somehow made it difficult to become a democracy. So there was some implied relationship between oil and democratic weakness. And that seemed to me a very simplistic way to think about how the two are connected. That if you're if you're a state dependent on oil, you therefore find it harder to be democratic. And the arguments for that kind of view went back 20, 30 years. Even back to the 70s, to the oil boom, when everybody had thought that development was a problem because developing countries didn't have enough capital. And suddenly there were all these oil countries with huge amounts of capital, and yet they didn't seem to develop, or if they did, they didn't seem to do it in a proper and a democratic way. So there was a lot of rather unhelpful history of writing about oil and development, oil and democracy. And I wanted to rethink the whole question of the relationship between fossil fuels and democracy to make better sense initially just of what was happening with the war in Iraq and the public discourse then, which is a different context from the book today. So what I set out to do actually was to look at the much longer history of the relationship between fossil fuels and democracy, and to actually compare the rise of coal in the 19th century, and particularly the late 19th century, with the rise of a second fossil fuel and our dependence on it in the 20th century. And the curious thing was that one could see that dependence on coal actually was a very important moment in the history of democracy. And not just because it created industry and large cities and things like that, but because it created a vulnerability. Industrialized countries were suddenly dependent on a single source of energy, particularly in Northern Europe. And that dependence made it possible for movements of workers to shut down an energy system. Coal moved along very narrow, very vulnerable routes from the coal face pit head to the docks to the power stations. And it was possible for the first time in history for workers to organize in actually relatively small numbers, but strategically to shut down that energy system. And I argued in the book that that was actually the source of modern mass democracy, that particular power for a while. And so that made that that was the context in which to think of the difference oil made. And it made a lot of differences, but one of them was it kind of diversified sources of carbon energy. And it spread them across the globe because oil was much cheaper to transport across large distances. And it took away from workers for a long time that ability to threaten to shut down an energy system and therefore that ability to start demanding a whole range of political and social rights that had been built initially on the basis of that power. So that was the underlying idea, but then the book connects that to a lot of wider questions about our conception, our everyday conception of the economy, how that connects with questions of energy, of infinite growth, and in the later chapters of the book, questions around climate change and how those more historical arguments about fossil fuels might be used to think about the politics of climate crisis.
Yeah, I mean, some of the specifics that you get into in the book are around the shift within, like, for example, the British Navy from coal to oil and how that was linked to the threat that worker strikes had presented for British imperial power. Winston Churchill advocated for that, which you detail in the book, I believe, that switch. I'm sure that he was not the only figure involved. But just detailing a little bit more the ways that that shift to oil was actually about closing that space or that democratic space that opened. And I think a lot of people might not really conceptualize or have not made that link between the social space that was opened by mass fossil fuel distribution and labor rights. So if you could underline that a little bit more, I think that would be really helpful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, so lots of people have written about the rise of mass democracy in the West. There's really a critical period between the late 19th century and the mid 20th century. There is a longer history of certain forms of democracy, representative, liberal, constitutional government, in which, of course, only a very small number of people actually enjoyed democratic rights. And there's a switch from that to mass democracy, which happens in the places where it does happen, largely in the late 19th, early 20th century. And I suggest the critical difference was not the standard factors that are usually given. The standard factors are, well, with a sort of second industrial revolution, you had much larger cities, you had much larger groupings of urban populations, and you had the ability of those populations to organize labor unions and things of that sort. All of that, of course, happened. But I think if you actually look at the critical moments in a whole range of countries, it wasn't just that there were urban populations and it wasn't just that there were labor unions. It was that a particular alliance of workers, namely the coal miners, the dock workers, and the railway workers, were able to work together, even actually without sort of formal coordination. But what linked them together was the routes along which the coal moved. And in contrast to earlier energy systems, which were largely renewable based, forests and river systems, and or just sunlight, this energy was so concentrated in both the sources that it came from, the coal mines, the routes on which it moved, and the places where it was used, particularly the new electrical power generating stations, that you actually only needed to put pressure in a very few key points, docks, coal mines, power stations. And for the first time ever in history, you could shut down a country's energy system. And the word for that shutdown was a general strike. And this was the origins of this phenomenon called the general strike, which was a major weapon, again, between when it was sort of first threatened in the late 19th century through to the mid 20th century, when gradually the power was taken away. So it's taken a sort of well-known fact that forms of mass democracy have this specific history in a key period, but it's resituating the explanation in the very way in which energy is produced and distributed, and it's understanding that power, that democratic power, as based upon a certain power of interruption or sabotage. So again, whereas a standard view of democracy would often tend to be either about social movements or about a certain kind of, you know, coming to awareness of rights and interests, a sort of mental process of people becoming democratic, I tend to work from the assumption that people generally everywhere in the world want a better life and a more just and a more viable form of collective living. But the difference is they can't get that listened to, and they don't have that ability to make those in power listen. And there was just this moment when suddenly those in power had no choice, because if they didn't listen, the lights went off and the means of heating and running industry and so on were cut off. And that was a rare moment. So that's how the argument of the book differs from general histories of the rise of mass democracy. It's a focus on a power of sabotage or a power of interruption or a power to inconvenience that happens quite often actually to be located in energy systems. And when the sort of second half of the book moves to oil, or really most of the book after the first couple of chapters, you also sort of want to look at that technical level of why it was that oil was not open to the same kind of sabotage. It wasn't that people didn't try. Across the Middle East in particular, as it became the world's major oil producing region in the middle decades of the 20th century, there was wave after wave of attempt to organize strikes and to demand political and worker rights and other improvements. But they could be shut down because for a number of reasons, again, connected to the way energy was produced and moved. It's liquid, so you don't have to send workers underground, so they're much easier to supervise and control on the surface. It moves in pipelines, which are you can interrupt the flow, but it's much easier to interrupt the movement of something by rail as coal was moved than in pipelines. And then it goes in tankers, and the tankers can be rerouted anywhere, so no particular strike in one location is going to interrupt that movement. And the other argument I make is that it's not that sabotage disappeared as a sort of political weapon, but it changed hands, because it actually fell into the hands of the oil companies, because they were the one who could now control the flow, limit the flow to force prices up when they needed to, and turn that movement of oil, of energy, not into a weapon of improved democracy, but a weapon of extraordinary corporate profits. And understanding that switch, that ability to interrupt and to energy flow actually becomes a kind of corporate power, because the profits they made depended not on producing oil, but much more on limiting its production and monopolizing that production. So there's an argument, the other half, if you like, of the argument about democracy is how that power of interruption or sabotage shifts dramatically from the kinds of popular forces whose hands it had been in, into the hands of well-organized multinational corporations.
Well, you actually challenge the sort of location of the story of oil in the Middle East from a story of seeking abundance to limiting oil access for corporations. There's so much to talk about. I also just wanted to mention that you did highlight this book by Puget from 1909 called Le Sabotage. And I thought that that was really great reference to see the ways that like direct action as a tool of democracy is important in terms of the origins of the union struggles that you
A very important book translated into English, and not only very important among organizers and activists, but also being taken up politically. The key thinker who takes it up is a mainly forgotten economist, Thorsten Veblen, who actually was the first person to sort of make the argument I've just made, which is that you can interrupt industrial processes. And you can do that in the way we understand sabotage in that historic sense, as workers organizing to interrupt the way in which things are produced or moved. Veblen's argument was, well, that actually happens all the time, but it's really a power in the hands of business firms that are run not for purposes of productive efficiency, but for purposes of profit. And when your goal is profit, often what you're looking for is things like monopoly. And creating a monopoly is often a process of sabotaging everyone else. So there's very interesting history of the term sabotage in the early 20th century, and this sort of battle over who has the hands to, who has the power to interrupt the way in which industrial society allows goods to flow.
So there's a lot to get into around the book Carbon Democracy, but I guess, you know, we have limited time, so I'll just go to this last point, which is the power of fossil fuels to sort of provoke fundamental questions. And so I'm thinking about Canada. I know this isn't in the book, but I'm thinking about, for example, the Wet'suwet'en Nation, you know, and the challenges over, you know, the fundamental essence of the Canadian state as a colonial occupation force in the context of Wet'suwet'en, the Sequoyah people, many different Indigenous communities who are challenging these oil and gas pipelines. And beyond the challenge and the assertion of Indigenous rights or sovereignty, which is another discussion your book addresses, I don't know if we have the time to get into that, but the section on and the book on that is really meaningful, the way that sovereignty conceptions are manipulated by power. But just in terms of like Indigenous people, just any thoughts about the ways that still there is that vulnerability that you talked about, because, you know, those actions, although they haven't halted the construction entirely of these pipelines, have raised very fundamental questions about the entire legitimacy of the Canadian the state as it exists.
Yeah, it's been fascinating. I mean, I've watched it and followed it from a distance. I don't have anything like the knowledge that you have, and I'm sure many of your listeners and watchers will have. And of course, there's been on a smaller scale, similar issues, pipeline issues in the US, of course, connected to the Canadian oil production. No, I think it's enormously important to, and you know, I think it's part of a larger process of understanding that politics has this technical dimension, although we're trained to think that politics happens in legislatures and through the passing of laws or the blocking of laws. Of course, it also happens on the ground. And if that ground is itself the subject of sovereignty claims or stolen sovereignty, that groundedness, that very technical groundedness of politics in the systems that move energy and the sites where that fossil energy is produced, you know, there's enormous breakthroughs, I think, in understanding those connected processes of energy production and movement on the one hand, the technical equipment on which that is thoroughly dependent, and how you can actually turn those into you know, sites, as you say, of sort of political awareness as well as direct political action. And I think that's been an enormously important aspect, certainly, as you say, of contemporary Canadian politics, but also in the US.
Thanks so much, Timothy Mitchell.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Stefan.
That was a conversation with Timothy Mitchell, the author of Carbon Democracy, here on Free City Radio, an exploration on the ways that fossil fuels have shaped Western political consciousness and the economy over the last 100 years. This is a book that looks critically at the ways that colonialism, British Empire, and more generally US imperialism over the last 100 years has worked to create dependency on fossil fuels, which of course today is propelling the environmental crisis around the world. That was a discussion with Timothy Mitchell, the author of Carbon Democracy. This has been Free City Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm Stefan Christoff. It is the 13th of October. We broadcast every Wednesday at 11 o'clock. You can also find our podcast online. Just search Free City Radio through Apple Podcasts. To go out on the program today, I'm going to feature a piece of music from the group Asian Dub Foundation. Stay tuned to CKUT. Coming up next is the F-Files.
Today, the color line is the power line, is the poverty line. color line is the power line, is the poverty line.
Sanctified vagabond, speak upon kings. Praise be the king of the fringe. Why not go ahead? Meditate up in the mountain like two mountain dread. Staple, no shout, racking that cold fish and bread. Babylon in my vein, can I shake that out my system? Dip down, get flat, smack the floor. 28 days on tour, the civil in me dwindle. We kindle the hooligan, conspiracy addict. Sporadic bouts of murderous thought. Fully qualified loon, shaking a fist at the moon. Scrolling notes of protest to the MI5. Screaming, what makes thee? Keep files on me, just because to break the twigs off the sycamore tree. Place it in some water and we sip once and see. Transmit to transmit frequencies, utilities at the green matter mass. Way past the dust, ash to ash.
Way past the dust, ash to ash.
Gog and Father, stepping out of place, pure Bible. If he can tribal, praise no idol. Penetrate maps in the valley for cash. Two twos we flash, flee this place. Valley too creepy, steal my grace. I'm checking, boot trekking, only for earth stepping. Warming up the arts of old devil coping, yeah. Folks, he's praise when my man ends all. Warming easy kicking style to your sensor. I spread my spine, I'm rich with earth's tips. We makes like we slick, Lord knows that we slick. But these brands are stickies of an acquired yearn. We cushion the ill as Babylon turn. Too gripping to rhyme flips like misers to money. Slap to blackjack, but me shun Jim Rummy Wees. Earth stepper, we cruising our step and we not keep no frowns if a friend. We were never victims of trends. I draw. In the item mode, rolling the ball, let it be called this old hat. Classical maps, back to front, word stunt, toe punts in top corners. No braids in my sauna, free form, brainstormer. Dawn of dawn, dawning. I see the morning, I hear the calling. Yeah, some of them are nippy end, some of them are kooky end, some of them say frigid end, some of them say kinky in the grip of Skid Valley. There ain't that much love, just the need to exist by any which means. Frauds in my midst, never trusted my shit. Now them said frauds, they eat for my shit. Juggle out, keep bubbling on. Juggle out, keep bubbling on. I talk.
exploring feminism and technology through space and time.
My name is Moon Jaren, and I'm currently the Vice President of Operations at a cryptocurrency company called Vow Currency. It is a company that's based out of Jersey. And I'm also just joining as a Chief Marketing Officer for Villander. It is a blockchain-based climate change company who actually helps corporations and individuals to become net zero in their carbon consumption. I'm also an industry associate at University College London for their Center for Blockchain Technology as well.
Wow, excellent. Very busy. So can you explain just like a bit of the very basics of what is blockchain technology, how it's used, what it's good for, what interests you particularly about it?
Absolutely. You know, I've been really trying to think to explain it so that even a 2-year-old or a 9-year-old who has never used technology can actually understand it. So blockchain is really a system, is the technology where there's a multiple user there. And whenever, let's say, you know, let's take banking, because almost everybody understand when a transaction happen, a block is created. And once that block is created, you can no longer go delete it, make any types of change to it, or you either